on operations. The new recon men proved themselves to Blackburn as all just magnificent guys. One was a colorful soul, Master Sergeant Charles Pops Humble, a World War II veteran of the 1st Special Service Force, or as the Germans nicknamed it, the Devil's Brigade, the joint U.S.-Canadian airborne raider outfit from which modern special forces evolved. When he arrived at SOG and learned he could carry any weapon he desired, Humble had to have a German Schmeisser submachine gun, the handy weapon sprayed at him in many a World War II firefight. He was a study in contrasts. One recon man said, "Charlie was as tough as woodpecker lips," while another recalled that Humble's tenor voice could sing Danny Boy with such feeling that I practically had tears in my eyes. Major Scotty Crear thought the old NCO was proving a fine recon man, but one day Humble came into his office to announce, "Sir, I think I should be off the teams." Crear asked, "I can do the work," Humble explained, "but it takes me too long to recover my breath when we're being chased, and I think it endangers the rest of my team." Crear realized that that was more a consideration for others than for his own benefit. So Pops Humble ended up in supply and created two SOG traditions. First, when her man announced it was time he stopped running recon, no one said a thing. His peers understood the incredible stress and danger and respected an experienced man's decision when he said enough. And second, when a former recon man like Humble went to a staff or support job, he did his absolute best to help, whatever it took. When a recon 1-0 went to supply for, say, a suppressed Uzi submachine gun, instead of some self-important nitwit demanding justification, he found an old hand who'd used that weapon himself, and not only fetched one instantly, but shared his own experiences with it. In early 1966, U.S. Ambassador to Laos William Sullivan eased his restrictions a bit, authorizing SOG helicopters to insert teams and expanding SOG's operational area so that instead of just two small boxes, the whole 200-mile Laotian frontier could be crossed to a depth of 20 kilometers, about 12 miles. To explore this expanded operational area, SOG began increasing its U.S.-led recon teams, which, in mid-1966, jumped from 5 to an authorized 20 teams, plus several raider companies. To man all these new elements, Blackburn set up a Montagnard recruiting program. The Montagnards, a French term meaning mountain people, were South Vietnam's largest minority, organized along tribal lines somewhat like American Indians. The Jarai, Rade, Sedang, and Bru each had a distinct culture and history and homeland. Some tribes boasted a written language and Christian religion, while others were nomadic hunters and foragers, who, well into the 1960s, still used crossbows. Each Montagnard tribe hand-wove cloth for sarongs and loincloths in its own unique pattern, somewhat as the Scottish clans did their tartans. Apart from their loincloths and brass ring jewelry, Montagnards also could be distinguished from ethnic Vietnamese by their darker skin and stockier builds. Proudly self-reliant and scrupulously honest, the Montagnards may have lived in simple huts, but, like many poor people, they were generous and did not think themselves deprived. In some distant past, they had populated Vietnam's coast, living much like the ethnically related Polynesians they so clearly resembled. The more sophisticated Annamese emigrated from China and forced the Montagnards into inaccessible hill country. Few Montagnards supported the Viet Cong, which they considered a Vietnamese institution. SOG sent a number of American recon men to tribal villages, where they soon learned you didn't just mosey in and hire Montagnards. There was an etiquette about it. When Jim Hetrick and J.D. Bath arrived at a village, they were ushered through scurrying ducks and chickens to a communal longhouse on stilts, where a shriveled man squatted, said nothing, and just sized them up. An old pipe hung from a gap in his teeth, and the elderly chief just puffed and puffed. Finally, he waved them over. Bath could sense an animosity, but couldn't put a finger on it. Speaking through an interpreter, the recon men learned an American civic action team had dug a well for the village, but, the chief grumbled, the leader had promised him a pipe and left without giving him one. Fast on his feet, Bath widened his eyes. So you're the chief we've been looking for. We're sorry we don't have it with us, but we know, and we will bring it. The two Green Berets rushed to a PX and came back with two cans of Prince Albert tobacco and a couple of pipes, which they gave to the grinning old chief. We apologize that, because of the war, him being a chief, he'd understand that some things take time, Bath recalled. The village was ours after that. One of Bath's recruits had been an impressed bicycle porter in Laos, kidnapped by the NVA from his village and kept placated with assurances that the NVA were in radio contact with his village and that his family was just fine. Finally, he escaped and found his family nearly starved. Here was a man ready to fight, and the enemy's loss was Sog's gain. Hell, he was a walking war library, Bath said. He'd find things on the trail or cuts in trees and tell you exactly what they meant. Up to then, we'd never thought too much about it. Crossed lines on a trail meant, this path is booby-trapped, go this way, all kinds of things. Unlike most NVA soldiers, the Montagnards actually had grown up in the jungle. It was like having a bunch of bird dogs around. These jokers were so good, Bath found. They could see things grow. For Bath and his fellow Green Berets, the word Montagnard was too long and too formal. Soon it was shortened to Yard. The Yards called themselves by single names since everyone in the village knew Mitt or Angayo. Why complicate life with surnames? But this presented a problem when yards from different villages had identical names. RT California 10 Joe Walker solved it easily enough by dubbing two such men Woe-1 and Woe-2, and within a few weeks their numerical surnames took. The Green Berets did not think of yards or nungs as mercenaries, though that's what they were. Nor were they considered mere employees, though a 10 could hire, fire, fine, or give them bonuses. The relationship was more like a coach and an athletic team. For most yards, pay was unimportant, and they frittered away their money within days of getting it. They were like kids, a 10 recalled. On payday, they'd go downtown to a dentist and have these red and blue caps put on their teeth. They fought not for money, but because they were proud of their tribe and village and detested the enemy. It was their natural inclination to fight Vietnamese, with only a slightly greater disdain for the northern variety. The animosity was mutual. Vietnamese called the Yards Moi, which means savage. The Yards couldn't have cared less about South Vietnam as a country and felt no allegiance to some abstract paymaster like the United States, but they were loyal and ready to die for their recon teammates, American and Yard alike. Training his team's Montagnards for recon was the 10's responsibility, probably the first time since the American Civil War that a single leader recruited and trained the men he would lead into combat. Recon training proved a challenge to resourcefulness and patience because, in addition to unavoidable misunderstandings when instructing through an interpreter, most yards had no formal education. A wise 10, therefore, kept classes short and simple, repetitiously drilling his recruits in critical skills so they could be performed by rote. One effective technique I used was giving each yard his own toy soldier. During tactics classes, I positioned the toys representing the yards in a sandbox terrain model and was able to teach some fairly sophisticated maneuvers. But the biggest mistake you could make was to underestimate the Montagnards. When Lloyd O'Daniels took over RT California, he led the team to a local range to evaluate how well they handled their weapons. Amid it all, he paused, astonished. All of a sudden, I noticed, they're watching me to see how good I am. Rarely did a 10 need to dress down a Montagnard over some infraction. Just a slight suggestion, and his yard team leader or interpreter would straighten the wrongdoer out. Likewise, when the team needed a replacement, the Yards could be entrusted to find a suitable candidate. But no matter how long the Yards were around Sog Men, they still retained superstitions. One recon team leader, Ansel Sonny Franks, had a Jari who grew sicker and sicker before his Yard teammates finally explained which doctor put curse on him. At their urgings, Franks brought animals for sacrifice and sent the ailing man to the witch doctor with a modest honorarium. It worked, Sonny said. Hell, he came back spry as a chicken. The Montagnards found everything about America and Americans fascinating. On R.T. Washington, I had one Yard, Knott, who could sit quietly watching Americans for hours, as though he were watching television. One evening he showed up at our team room door, knocked politely, and I opened it to find him locked at a parade rest in U.S. khakis and a green beret and spit-shined boots, begging Joe Kiroz and myself to inspect him, which we did with grave formality. And he loved it. About the same time that the Montagnards joined SOG, a new weapon arrived in SOG's arsenal. Based on the Colt Car 15 survival rifle, it featured a barrel half the length of an M16's and a collapsible stock, a deadly but compact weapon that fit a recon man's needs to a T. The Swedish K and other 9mm submachine guns always would be a part of SOG's armory. But after 1966, they became special-purpose weapons, usually employed only with suppressors. Though often called silencers, these devices more accurately are now called suppressors, since they reduce but do not eliminate a weapon's report. It was a 1-0's prerogative to arm his men as he saw fit, and he had dozens of different weapons to choose among, from Soviet-made RPG rocket-propelled grenade launchers to Walther PPK-suppressed pistols. The Car 15, however, would reign supreme as SOG's trademark. In fact, SOG Recon would be the only unit armed entirely with Car 15s. That summer of 1966, as the new Car 15s were arriving, SOG began executing a new mission, Bomb Damage Assessment, BDA, which required landing in an area freshly devastated by B-52 bombers to survey the results for the Strategic Air Command, SAC. It was without precedent to use ground teams to examine strategic bomber targets. It had not been attempted in either World War II or Korea. Think of it. These targets were thought so concentrated with enemy as to justify hitting them with B-52s in arc light strikes, as they were codenamed, and as quickly as the dust settled, American-led SOG teams landed right there, among hundreds, perhaps thousands, of well-armed, hostile, and upset enemy troops. To watch a B-52 strike go in was an unforgettable experience, a withering spectacle almost too complex to visualize. Where just one 500-pound bomb strikes, a geyser of orange clay vividly shoots through the greenery. A concussion shockwave reverberates outward in billowing concentric rings that strip leaves and lift dust. Dirty smoke drifts skyward. Then, to make the earthquake complete, enormous trees collapse slowly inward and expose a fresh crater large enough to hold a small truck. That's one 500-pound bomb. Multiply such a cataclysm by 109, the number of bombs in a single B-52, and imagine all those bombs crashing to Earth in 3 seconds. The rumbling explosions overlap and churn up an area 2 blocks wide and more than a mile long, pounding destruction advancing on a front you can watch from the air. And that's just one B-52. Each arc light involved an entire formation of the swept-wing bombers, anywhere from 3 to 24 aircraft, up to 2,616 bursting bombs, a man-made maelstrom consuming as much as 2 miles by 6 miles, with the bombs bursting close enough to overlap each other, a rippling carpet of concussion, geysers, and falling greenery that resembled the path of a tiller upturning a swath of thick grass. From their aircraft, the BDA team would think, God, What must it be like beneath that? Sog found out. If you've ever seen what a tornado does to woodland, that's what they found. But with the bonus complication of fresh, loose-earth bomb craters everywhere. About half the time, teams encountered NVA swarming from their subterranean bomb shelters like wasps reacting to their nests being whacked, and the fight was on. They, SAC, thought that we'd find a lot of dazed and shaken people wandering around on the surface, recalled Chief SOG Colonel Steve Cavanaugh, 1968-70. Unless the bombs caught the NVA above ground, this was not the case. When a BDA team had to fight, the Air Force's Strategic Air Command was happy because it confirmed the enemy was there in numbers, but too many arc lights hit nothing due to faulty or old intelligence. Despite their frequent ineffectiveness, though, the B-52s were doing an impressive job of exposing the Ho Chi Minh trails, roads, and paths simply by blasting away the heavy jungle. And though the enemy expanded his engineer troops to keep pace with the needed repairs, arc-light craters and landslides often closed stretches of road temporarily. For the performing BDAs for SAC, confirming U-2 airborne photos intelligence or helping analysts determine how the Ho Chi Minh Trail operated, by mid-1966, SOG Recon had established an unequaled reputation in the intelligence community for being able to go anywhere and do anything. Not since the French and Indian War had Americans operated so deep in an enemy-controlled wilderness. By July 1966, SOG's Shining Brass program had conducted 48 missions into the enemy's heavily defended Laotian sanctuaries without losing one American in ground combat. There had been only 8 Green Berets wounded, and not a one seriously. It was too good to last. That summer, SOG shifted teams to Khe San to run targets in Vietnam's DMZ, Demilitarized Zone, a 14-mile-wide strip between North and South Vietnam, as well as west into Laos along the old unused Highway 9, which led across the border and 30 miles down a flat valley to Chiponé, a major NVA road hub. Standing like a sentinel guarding the Laotian frontier was Ko Rock, a 3-mile-wide limestone bluff that rose nearly 2,000 feet above Highway 9. From Ko Rock north in Laos was a region of karst limestone buttes, rising chimney-like from the jungle floor, some as small as factory smokestacks and others 1,000 feet wide. The karst zone ranged 90 miles north to the Mu Ya Pass. Northward from Khe San was nothing, not a road, not a village, not anything that spoke of man, not even a distinct landmark, just a hodgepodge of nearly identical hills, each rising about 1,500 feet, and together forming a uniform pattern like an upside-down egg carton, arrayed in a confusing sameness amid a spiderweb of shallow creeks. This was the terrain all the way up to the DMZ, some 15 miles away, and well into North Vietnam. SOG launched teams into these areas from the Little Special Forces A camp beside Khe San airstrip, a place almost as miserable and weathered in as Cam Duc, the original Shining Brass fob. This virgin territory gave up much information to the SOG teams. Among the early discoveries was Bicycle Canyon, a narrow valley where the NVA made final adjustments to their portage bikes before sending them south. Captured NVA pack bikes were found to be heavy-framed 2- or 3-wheelers with wide balloon tires, somewhat like today's mountain bikes. Saigon analysts learned that a single bicycle carried nearly 500 pounds of cargo, far more than a man could carry. As the SOG men learned, a porter walked his loaded bike from one way station to the next, then rode it back for the next load. Like NVA truck drivers, a bicycle porter was assigned a fixed stretch of road or path and came to know it so well, he could travel it even on dark nights. Truck traffic west of the DMZ was heavy, with large convoys rolling every night unless an airstrike closed the road. Then NVA bulldozers and laborers rushed to fill bomb craters and clear debris, repairing it so quickly that the Air Force sometimes found it hard to believe SOG reports of renewed use. NVA troops heading south were self-sustaining so as not to burden their already overtaxed logistics pipeline. This meant soldiers walked rather than rode aboard trucks, and as they departed North Vietnam, they carried their first several weeks' provisions. NVA troops stationed permanently along the trail hunted wild game and grew crops to supplement their diet. And everywhere, the SOG teams found, the enemy practiced astounding camouflage discipline. Were it not for the B-52 strikes, most roads would never have been visible from the air. Base camps, truck parts, and cache sites simply were impossible to discover except by ground reconnaissance. The key SON teams came to rely on those two dynamic King Bee flyers, Cowboy and Mustachio, who retrieved recon men under any kind of fire in any kind of weather. Mustachio flew a remarkable chopper rescue one night in mid-1966 after a recon team was hit in its overnight position and managed to escape, but burdened with several wounded, seemed certain to be caught before daylight. American Hueys could not fly in darkness, and neither should the Vietnamese H-34s, but Mustachio announced he would give it a try. Since this was almost suicidal, he flew without a co-pilot or door gunner. In complete darkness, Mustachio found the team and got them all out despite heavy ground fire. "How he ever did it, I don't know," Scotty Creeross said. "The chopper came out with 88 holes in it, and the pilot's thumb shot off." Tragically, a few weeks later, Mustachio was flying RT Nevada back to Con Tum, when not far from Cam Duc, his helicopter fell apart at 5,000 feet. The old H-34's tail, designed to pivot for storage on aircraft warriors, had come loose, swung around and chewed the helicopter to pieces in midair, ejecting its passengers and crew to a nightmarish death. In addition to Mustachio and his crew, lost was RT Nevada, Master Sergeant Ralph Reno, Staff Sergeant Donald Fawcett and their nungs, plus an operations officer, Captain Edwin McNamara. SOG teams recovered all the bodies except Reno's. 3 weeks later, a recon team led by Sergeant Major Harry D. Whalen, the Con Tum NCOIC, inserted west of Khe San. Whalen may have been the FRB Sergeant Major, but he preferred a rucksack and a Car 15 to a desk and in-out box. During the third day of their mission, they needed water, so they climbed down the back slope of Khô Rock to a wide stream. Whalen waved over his assistant team leader, Sergeant First Class Delmer Outlaw Laws, and Specialist 4 Donald Sane, the team radio operator. Laws and two nungs would get water first, Whalen whispered, and he and Sane would cover them. He and Sane stayed slightly back while the forward party began filling canteens. As Whalen leaned towards Sane to whisper to him, Sane's face exploded in a burst of AK-47 slugs. There wasn't even time to return fire. Hundreds of bullets cracked the air, slapped the ground, ripped through leaves. Whalen dove off the riverbank. The nungs and Laws jumped into the water too, and headed downstream, away from Whalen, but there was too much fire to follow them. So he sloshed upstream as hard as he could. The NVA were everywhere, the numbers doubling every 10 seconds. It must have been a company, 100 men, swarming, leaping into the water, shouting, splashing behind him, firing at nothing and everything. Whalen saw a place where the grassy bank overhung the river, and without thinking, he dove into it. Gasping to catch his breath, Whalen pressed himself as far back into the shadow as he could and tried to stay motionless. AK-wielding gunmen sloshed past, then stopped, circled back, and slowly began a detailed search, reconning here and there with a burst of bullets. Miraculously, the slugs slapped the water and ricocheted around Whalen, but not one hit him. Whalen dared not pull his survival radio because the enemy was all around him, just a few feet away. He wondered what had happened to Laws and the Nungs. Then he heard the first scream. He wasn't sure if the voice was Nung or American, but it definitely was an agonized human cry, not 30 yards away. Waylon's first instinct was to rush out, car 15 blazing, and kill all these bastards, or at least die trying. But he paused. That's exactly what they wanted him to do, so they could kill him and wipe out the whole team. No, Waylon vowed. Never. There was a rifle shot, a pause, then a different voice cried out. Waylon realized the North Vietnamese had executed one man and begun torturing another. A few minutes later, there was a second shot and a fresh, agonized cry. Waylon heard more screams, peaking, haunting cries. More NVA walked past, scanning the bank, alert, ready. A brave man, Waylon began to feel a terror he'd never before experienced. His hands and knees spasmed so that he thought the searchers surely would hear him. Waylon waited there, motionless, until long after dark, then waded upriver. Eventually a chopper came in and got him alone. Up to now, the North Vietnamese had been dealing with fleeting shadows that ambushed them, planted mines, and called airstrikes on their encampments. Now they learned who these will-o'-the-wisps were. Sane's and Law's bodies, yielded maps, codes, radios, car 15s, everything. At last, the NVA had something concrete to study and plan countermeasures against. 2 days later, SOG inserted a body recovery team led by Master Sergeant Billy Waugh and Major Gerald Kilburn. They found Sane's body exactly where Whalen told them they would. The NVA left it crudely booby-trapped with a hand grenade, which Waugh deactivated, then slid the young 1-2's remains into a body bag. Delmar Law's body was not found. At the Khantoum FOB, there was a somber mixture of sympathy for Sergeant Major Harry Whalen, who hardly had spoken, and grief over the lost men, Delmar Laws and Don Sane. No one wanted the anguish of a memorial ceremony, especially seeing how badly Waylon was taking it, but something had to be done. So the recon men just gathered at the NCO club. There were drinks, some toasts, a few funny stories retold. After hours of anecdotes and toasts, someone proposed they sing a song, a fitting one for lost companions. Fine, green beret recon men who'd given their all. It was a sort of taps, a closure. Everyone in the club stood and sang, slow and sad. The song was, Hey Blue. I had a dog and his name was Blue. Bet you $5 he's a good dog, too. Hey Blue, you're a good dog, you. Several succeeding verses recalled old Blue's life, loyalty, and companionship, qualities like those that bonded the recon men to each other. Then old Blue died, and in that final verse, instead of calling the dog's name over his grave, all those gathered substituted the names of their lost comrades and sang sadly, Sane and Laws and Fawcett too, and Reno, Thorne, and McNamara too. Hey, friends. You were good guys, you. As the war continued and SOG losses mounted, verse after verse of names were added, which, like an oral history, reminded succeeding rotations of recon men who had gone before them. It was SOG's most solemn tradition. The night they sang Hey Blue to Laws and Sane, people eventually wandered away, some to be alone and think, others to prepare for missions, and a few to lose themselves in drink. Sergeant Major Waylon followed the last course. To the great disappointment of those who admired him, Waylon's drinking did not stop. One of the things that got to him was that Charlie, the NVA, knew he was in the area, and they kept kicking these guys to make them scream and holler, recalled J.D. Bath. But he was a super guy, and I really thought the world of him. Waylon also bore the onus as the first 1-0 to leave a man behind, creating a monumental case of survivor's guilt. If someone had called him a coward, Waylon could have beaten the hell out of him and been done with it. But how do you fight yourself? Each night Waylon would sit at the bar in the club, brooding, and get drunker and drunker, then with no warning, push his stool over backward, knocking himself senseless. No one knew what to do. In a burst of levity, the recon guys nicknamed him Crash and tried to joke him into stopping. But Weyland kept drinking himself into oblivion. This was a fine soldier, loved by everyone, but nothing could stop those haunting screams in his head. Then one night, as Crash slid onto his bar stool, some recon NCOs crowded around him, and before Weyland could stop them, they'd snapped a Huey seatbelt to the stool and to two newly installed clips on the bar so, as one of the NCOs recalls, he'd get whiplash, but he wouldn't hit that floor. Tragically, though, Weyland's drinking still did not stop. He carried those two guys in his rucksack for a long time, J.D. Bath said regretfully. The U.S. government could not tell the families the truth of where Sane and Laws had died. The families were only told that their loved ones had died in South Vietnam, a small lie that planted the seeds of post-war MIA conspiracy claims. The sad thing about losing anybody over there, said a later Chief SOG Colonel Steve Cavanaugh, was that you never could give credit to those people for what they were really doing. Those were bold and heroic operations, and you could never give credit for those kinds of things. You could write them up for a Silver Star or DSC, Distinguished Service Cross, or something like that, and you had to waffle around it, and it sounded like they'd gone out on a cookie bake of some kind, lost on a reconnaissance mission in South Vietnam. Official accounts so diminished SOG's true dangers that most awards were at least one degree below their legitimate level. The same security concerns prohibited distributing SOG's most critical intelligence for fear the source and means might be revealed. But when he thought American lives were at stake, Scotty Krierar followed his conscience. A couple of times we violated our directions and didn't report it, intelligence only to Saigon. We told the American units who were on the friendly side of the border, hey, there is some big stuff right across the fence. There were other problems. Our teams would be out on the Cambodian border and just getting the hell shot out of them, recalled a senior SOG officer, but they couldn't call upon regular army units for help. By the time SOG intelligence was filtered through all the necessary clearance and an American division completed its extensive planning and logistics preparations, the NVA were long gone. Colonel Blackburn once quipped to the 1st Division commander, "It's strange as hell. Your guys can't find the enemy, and we can't get rid of them." Eventually, SOG solved its intelligence distribution problem by creating a mythical Laotian partisan organization, the FGU, or Friendly Guerrilla Unit, to which Shining Brass information could be attributed. Once scoured of clues to its true origin, sterilized, and rooted through MACV, the FGU information was widely distributed to American units with no mention of SOG. In the fall of 1966, Lieutenant General Lewis W. Walt, 3rd Marine Amphibious Force Commander, requested SOG's special recon help in and near the DMZ. During the just-completed Operation Hastings, the Marines had pushed two NVA divisions back toward the DMZ, then occupied two dominating positions just south of there, Con Tien and a hill mass dubbed the Rock Pile. These two outposts attracted masses of NVA and continuing artillery fire from the DMZ. There was great uncertainty about where the two NVA divisions had gone, and some evidence the enemy was massing to seize South Vietnam's two northernmost provinces. The hills around Khe San and the DMZ were so alive that Marine recon teams found it impossible to stay on the ground. Was the enemy massing, falling back, reinforcing? What? And where was his artillery? General Walt needed to know. When SOG's recon teams packed their rucksacks to go north and support the Marines, they carried along a new item, wiretap devices. Over the past year, SOG teams had discovered dozens of enemy telephone lines along roads and trails, but until now they didn't have wiretaps and cassette recorders. These taps could produce intelligence of inestimable value, because landlines often carried messages too sensitive to transmit by radio. Plus, they might yield important clues for decrypting radio messages. However, the NVA's ability to detect taps electronically was so great that, at least initially, any team that planted a tap was living on borrowed time. Eventually, the CIA supplied induction tap devices, which used rubber-coated pads over the wire to glean a recordable signal from its electrical field. The CIA induction wiretap was not electronically detectable. Yet these operations remained fraught with hazard, because a landline phone system meant an NVA regiment or division was in the vicinity. Wiretaps began with SOG's USMC support missions that fall of 1966, when General Walt's staff selected 17 targets in the DMZ and adjacent areas in Laos. The first three SOG teams averaged less than 3 days on the ground, and two had to shoot their way out. The next three teams managed to avoid contact for just 2.5 days, then all three fought quick engagements and escaped, with one team bringing back a POW. On 28 September, an aggressive enemy force nearly overran a team near Khe San, splitting the Americans and Nungs. Staff Sergeant Danny Taylor and two Nungs were never seen again. 5 days later, recon teams Colorado and Arizona were inserted by Marine helicopters near Khe San. RT Colorado with Sergeants Ted Braden, Jim Hetrick, and J.D. Bath went in first, just north of the Benhai River on the western end of the DMZ. The choppers went back, picked up Master Sergeants Ray Echevera and Jim Jones, 10 and 11, plus Staff Sergeant Major Eddie Williams, 12, along with their Nungs, and again flew north, this time just 7 miles. Riding with the Covey FAC overhead was Sergeant Major Paul Darcy. The CH-46 Sea Knights carrying Arizona made it safely into the LZ, and had just lifted away when the enemy opened fire from 360 degrees all the way around the LZ. Arizona had landed amid an entrenched NVA unit. Heavy fire pinned down the team and kept the Marine helicopters at bay, with one bird taking 15 hits. Just 15 miles away, RT Colorado radio operator Jim Hetrick heard Echevarra's voice on the radio screaming, "Come and get us! You've got to come and get us!" Despite airstrikes around them, the heavy enemy fire couldn't be suppressed. Finally, RT Arizona 10 Echevarra's voice came back, calm. "That's it, guys," he announced. "It's all over. Don't come in. You haven't got a chance." Echevarra said they would never get out. "When I quit talking, put the shit right on us," he told Covey rider Darcy. Minutes later, U.S. fighter bombers dumped their bomb loads across RT Arizona's position. There were no further radio transmissions. Outnumbered almost 100-1, the team had been swallowed whole, the first entire SOG team lost to the enemy. Of the 7 helicopters that tried to retrieve RT Arizona, 6 were hit, as was an A-1 Sky Raider. Amazingly, none was shot down. 3 days later, RT Arizona's yard interpreter was extracted alive. He told debriefers he had evaded capture with the team 1-2, Staff Sergeant Eddie Williams, after Echevarra and Jones were mortally wounded. Williams had taken an AK-47 bullet through his thigh and sapped his strength climbing a cliff, after which he took shelter in a cave and told the interpreter to get help. A few minutes later, the interpreter heard AK fire and explosions near the cave, then total silence. A month later, an enemy POW told interrogators he'd seen a black man with a wounded thigh, hands tied behind his back and a noose around his neck, being led through villages for public mockery until he was too ill to walk. Then he was executed. Only 3 months had passed since recon men first gathered to sing Hey Blue, and already its final verse was crammed with names: Thorne, Laws, Sane, Reno, McNamara, Fawcett, Taylor, Echevarra, Jones, and Williams, and 1966 was far from over. Meanwhile, RT Colorado's mission had been a resounding success. Not only did the team uncover several NVA base camps, but they emplaced SOG's first wiretap and brought back 7 cassettes of North Vietnamese phone conversations. SOG wiretaps soon were recognized as incomparable intelligence sources. And despite the traumatic losses of recon men, SOG 10s were winning more than they were losing, particularly two who seemed to be able to pull off anything, Master Sergeants Jerry Waring and Dick Meadows. General Westmoreland was so impressed by both that he gave them direct commissions and cited them by name in his memoirs. Under Waring, RT Ohio had a recurring problem. Waring's team quit en masse every time he came back. Major Scotty Creary said he did such hell-raising things that they would quit. Several times RT Ohio bumped into enemy right on their insert LZ, but instead of asking to be extracted to land elsewhere, Waring fought his way through. Waring pulled that a couple of times, Creerar reports. Good instincts. He pulled it off. A man of death-defying audacity, Waring brought back almost a dozen enemy prisoners from Laos, a record bettered only by RT Ohio 10 Dick Meadows. They were a study in contrasts. Where Waring was instinctive, Meadows was methodical. Meadows did everything meticulously. Everything was rehearsed. You could have taken a film of his mission preparation and used it as a training film, Major Creerar recalled. When he came to Shining Brass in 1966, Meadows had been a professional soldier 19 years, though he was only 34. Born in a dirt-floor moonshiner's cabin in West Virginia, Meadows had lied about his age to become a 15-year-old paratrooper in 1947, then so distinguished himself in Korea that he was that war's youngest master sergeant. Before an operation, Meadows would build a terrain map in the dirt, then have his whole team, Americans and Hmongs, memorize the prominent features, all the LZs, streams, and rally points. Then they'd take turns reciting the plan and pointing to sites in the model. He would work them hard, Creerar said. Much of Meadows' reputation came from his ability to capture prisoners. He held SOG's record, 13 POWs snatched from behind enemy lines. Despite his great emphasis on planning, though, Meadows could act with boldness when it was needed. He once had RT Iowa hidden beside a trail, when 5 NVA strolled up and stopped right there for lunch. Meadows emerged and announced, "You are now POWs." 3 of the NVA started for their AKs, and Meadows shot all 3 dead instantly. The other 2 proved compliant. Meadows also had a knack for being in the right place to make history. In 1966, he proved North Vietnamese Prime Minister Pham Van Dong a flagrant liar. Early that year, Pham adamantly insisted not a single North Vietnamese soldier was fighting in South Vietnam. Lying beside Laotian Highway 110E, RT Iowa was watching North Vietnamese soldiers and porters file past when their 10 decided to take a chance. At great personal risk, Meadows pulled a Pen EE camera from his pocket, crawled forward, and snapped a whole roll of photos from such close range that the clicking shutter almost got him killed. Then Meadows and his 1-1, Chuck Kearns, crawled back beyond enemy earshot, and Meadows decided on an even more dangerous gambit. In Kearns' rucksack was his personal 8mm motion picture camera, which he'd brought along on a lark. Meadows crawled perilously close to the highway and began rolling. He shot a few perfectly exposed frames of each man who came into his viewfinder. For an hour, Meadows lay there and recorded hundreds of heavily armed North Vietnamese marching alongside porters toting military supplies. The color film was rushed to Washington. Chief SOG Colonel Jack Singlaub, who had taken over from Colonel Don Blackthorne in April 1966, had Meadows personally present his findings to General Westmoreland, who could not help but praise Meadows and SOG. Meadows' footage was shown before a closed-door briefing of select members of Congress who needed convincing that Hanoi was lying about its involvement in South Vietnam. A few months later, Meadows went into a heavily patrolled area west of Khe San and penetrated an enemy cache containing new artillery pieces and fire control equipment. The howitzers were too big to carry back, so he photographed them, then stripped them of sights. Again, Chief Sog had Meadows brief General Westmoreland. The intense young master sergeant presented Westmoreland a souvenir. A Soviet-made artillery sight from the Laotian cache. As General Westmoreland noted in his memoirs, it was such evidence which finally prompted the State Department to relax its restrictions on firing into the DMZ. Deeply impressed by the sincere, quiet-spoken Green Beret, Westmoreland recommended Meadows for a battlefield commission, promoting him to the rank of captain. It was only logical that Chief Sog chose Dick Meadows to lead Sog's first American operation into the heartland of North Vietnam. 4. Codename Bright Light. Lieutenant Dean Wood's crippled A-1 Sky Raider had limped within sight of the South China Sea, but the U.S. Navy pilot couldn't squeeze another mile out of her. Woods reached for the yellow handle between his legs and pressed himself back tight, and one tug later he was flying in space, his ejection seat falling away. For miles around, any North Vietnamese soldier could see Woods' propeller-driven Sky Raider plunge and explode as his parachute drifted west into the hills. The tree in which Lieutenant Wood landed was on a heavily jungled ridgeline about halfway between Vinh and Hanoi and almost 30 miles inland, overlooking rice paddies and dikes and villages. Lieutenant Woods realized he was between the two bomb-pocked highways that carried supplies from Haiphong's docks to the Muya Pass and the Ho Chi Minh Trail. Both roads, he knew, would be crawling with troops. Only about 15 miles away was the provincial capital, Than Hoa, which was certain to have a large garrison. Woods turned on his emergency radio, but the failing light told him he would see no rescue this day, 12 October, 1966. So he put some distance between himself and his telltale chute draped in the tree and found a place to hide for the night. It looked hopeful the next day. Escorted by A-1 Sky Raiders and high-flying Navy F-4 Phantoms, a Sikorsky SH-3C Sea King helicopter whirred above the ridgeline until, at last, the crew chief could see Woods waving his arms beneath the heavy canopy. While the A-1s strafed approaching enemy patrols, the hovering Sea King lowered an extraction rig from its winch, but the harness kept snagging in the trees. By the time it was clear this would not work, there was not enough station time left to talk Woods to an open area where the helicopter could land, nor enough daylight to fly out to sea, refuel, and return. They wished him good luck until the next day. But the next day, heavy fog and clouds blanketed the jungle around the Navy pilot, making rescue impossible, although a Navy plane communicated with him. All day, aircraft stood by, but the weather never broke. Out in the South China Sea, 7th Fleet Commander Admiral Leroy Johnson decided he could not just stand by with one of his men in such jeopardy. That night, Admiral Johnson cabled General Westmoreland in Saigon, requesting a small force to land in North Vietnam, search for the young aviator, and fight through any enemy that tried to interfere. Westmoreland phoned Chief Sog Colonel Singlob. While Singlob made preparations, political approval was sought, reportedly all the way to President Johnson. With that approval, Chief Sog called upon the best man he could imagine to lead the mission, 10 Dick Meadows. It was midnight by the time a Navy C-2 Greyhound transport delivered Meadows and his reinforced RT Iowa to the heaving deck of the USS Intrepid, and it was just as well, since the 13 heavily armed SOG men did not want to arouse unwanted speculation. This was the first mission under the codename Bright Light, top-secret rescues of Americans from behind enemy lines ever to be attempted in North Vietnam. But once again the weather refused to cooperate, and the SOG men could do little more than pace and hope for a break. It did not come. Beneath the shielding cloud cover, the North Vietnamese continued searching for Lieutenant Woods, who was now suffering through his third day without food. Enough time had passed that the NVA had trucked in additional 37mm and 57mm anti-aircraft guns to engage American rescue helicopters when they came, as the enemy knew they would. Several companies of NVA had arrived to reinforce the local militia. The next morning the clouds scattered, and just before dawn a pair of Navy Sea King helicopters lifted from the Intrepid's deck with Meadows and R.T. Iowa aboard. As the North Vietnamese coast took shape, there was an uncomfortable realization that ahead was a modern air defense system, whose radars already were tracking their approach and alerting anti-aircraft units and ground forces who'd had 4 days to prepare for them. When the helicopters crossed the coast, the sky exploded with anti-aircraft shell bursts, but the Navy pilots expertly weaved between the worst of it. Minutes later, they could see the heavily forested ridge where, at that very moment, the NVA were converging on the downed flyer. After several false insertions to confuse the enemy, one Sea King inserted R.T. Iowa about 800 yards from Lieutenant Wood's hiding place. Meadows made a beeline for the ridge. Lieutenant Woods could hear buzzing planes and helicopters and the booming of anti-aircraft guns, but his greatest concerns were more immediate. Brush was breaking nearby, and he could hear shouts of excited soldiers. Meadows and his men moved fast and had closed to a few hundred yards when they received a sickening radio report. The Navy pilot was captured. Had they traveled 500 miles only to come up 200 yards short? A cautious soldier would have taken his men to the nearest extraction point and departed enemy territory, Colonel Singlob says. But Meadows was not overly cautious. Coming upon a major trail, Meadows decided to set up an ambush and capture a prisoner. A few moments later, an NVA officer and 3 enlisted men walked up, alert, still searching for Woods, apparently unaware he'd been captured. Perhaps they expected a lone, injured pilot with just a pistol. They were astonished when Meadows stepped from the dense foliage and leveled his AK-47, calling a friendly good morning. As one, they went for their guns, but Meadows shot first, killing all 4 in one blur. While his men searched the bodies, Meadows radioed for an exfil, and soon they were flying away, although their helicopter was sprayed by gunfire and eventually had to ditch near an American destroyer. From this, their first bright light mission, every SOG man made it out. After the war, Meadows met Lieutenant Woods, who'd spent 6 years as a POW, and presented him with the Tokarev pistol captured from the NVA officer he'd wished good morning on the trail. It could be said bright light was Colonel Harry Heine Aderholt's personal creation. 6 months earlier, USAF General Hunter Harris, Pacific Air Force commander, had challenged the experienced special operations officer to develop a concept, what to do after a search and rescue, SAR effort, came up empty-handed, and one or more Americans were still evading, missing, or taken prisoner. A recent Air Force study had found that 47% of all failed SARs resulted from slow reaction time by helicopters. If a rescue bird could reach a downed airman within 15 minutes, the chances of rescue were good. But if retrieval took more than 30 minutes, the downed airman's chances fell precipitously. Colonel Aderholt decided a single office should handle all post-SAR responsibilities, and it should be in SOG, since this was the only joint service agency with assets and authorization to operate secretly throughout Southeast Asia. The Joint Chiefs agreed, and on 16 September 1966, authorized Aderholt to head SOG's Ops 80 section, to track MIAs, locate prison camps, attempt rescues, and even offer bribes and ransoms to get Americans released. Because Ops 80 needed to coordinate with many non-SOG entities, it would operate behind its own special cover, the Joint Personnel Recovery Center, JPRC. A supposed staff section in MACV. More than anything, though, Aderholt wanted to raid POW camps and liberate Americans. The very day Dick Meadows landed in North Vietnam, a teenage Viet Cong defector had offered to help SOG plan its first JPRC Bright Light raid. The 17-year-old defector had emerged from the swampy forest of the Mekong Delta on 30 August, and told U.S. interrogators his camp held an American POW. When questioned, he seemed to recognize the name Jackson. USAF Captain Carl E. Jackson had been MIA since his C-123 was downed southwest of Saigon on 27 June 1965. After aerial photography and even a polygraph seemed to confirm the youth's claims, the bureaucracy slowly moved forward until, at last, 5 weeks after he defected, SOG's Joint Personnel Recovery Center became involved. Working alongside Bill Simon's staff, Colonel Adderholt and JPRC planned a Hellebore rescue for 1 week later, which involved everyone from the 4th Corps Senior Advisor to the 7th Air Force Commander and 8 different sections of the MACV staff. Colonel Adderholt felt overwhelmed by bureaucracy. Meanwhile, in Khantoum, Operation Crimson Tide, a company-sized rescue was in preparation. SOG headquarters appointed a special mission commander, Captain Frank Jacks, who was a teenager in his native Czechoslovakia, had been an anti-Nazi resistance fighter. After the communists seized power in 1948, Jacks came west and, under the 1952 Lodge Act, which offered U.S. citizenship to 12,000 East European refugees for enlisting in the American Army, he signed up and went into special forces. He served his first Vietnam tour in 1963, earning one of the war's earliest Purple Hearts, and was now on his second tour. Short of Green Beret leaders for his 3rd Nong platoon, Jacks took on 2 volunteers for the mission, Sergeant First Class Charles Vessels, a former recon man, and Sergeant First Class Fred Huckleberry Lewis, a Special Forces engineer who had been constructing the SOG base at Khantoum. Friendly and easygoing, Huckleberry had a country way about him, and with an old straw hat propped above his freckled face, he needed just a piece of straw dangling from his teeth to perfectly impersonate the Twain character. Because the camp was about finished, at last Huckleberry could do what he'd come to SOG for in the first place. Fight. And what better operation than rescuing an American POW? Early on 18 October, Jack's raiding company and the VC defector were at the Khantoum airfield, but the C-130 assigned to airlift them was delayed. When they finally landed at Sok Trang, the staging base in the Mekong Delta where they married up with their lift helicopters, they were 4 hours late. There was no real briefing. During a fast open-air chat, an American 4th Corps advisor showed Jacks a map of the woodland containing the POW camp, 90 miles north of Vietnam's southern tip. The colonel said it would be lightly guarded by 12 men at most, with no other enemy units nearby, and estimated they would be in and out in 20 minutes. The colonel offered no real intelligence, just suppositions so limited that Jacks felt it was almost going in blind. Jacks had an uneasy feeling. 6 weeks had passed since the young VC had defected, and it seemed everybody and his brother knew about the rescue mission. On a hunch, Jacks decided to carry a double load of ammunition. It was a wise decision. In most raids, it would have been preferable to land atop or as close as possible to the objective, but fearing an ambush, Jack selected to land all 3 platoons aboard 12 Hueys on a large LZ about 500 yards away. Only a shallow canal and thin brush stood between the LZ and the camp, and they could cover that in minutes. Hurriedly, Jack boarded his men, and the 3 parallel lines of 4 Hueys each lifted away and turned south. 20 minutes later, the Hueys descended, but just before reaching the LZ, one string of 4 birds, carrying Huckleberry, Vessels, and the 3rd platoon, shifted east. Apparently, the Huey commander found the LZ too small to land all 12 helicopters simultaneously, and the 3rd Huey formation set down across the canal in another LZ, perfectly located at the edge of the camp. As Jacks and his 2 platoons landed, hellacious fire erupted 500 yards away at the other LZ. But there was fire here, too, so he could do little but organize his 1st and 2nd platoons and hope the best for the 3rd platoon. Jacks couldn't raise Vessels or Lewis on the radio. The Huey carrying Huckleberry Lewis and a squad of Nungs had flown into the intersecting fire of 50-caliber machine guns. The affable Green Beret fell from the aircraft mortally wounded, and the bird crashed. The other Hueys disgorged their passengers and flew clear, but SFC Vessels and his Nungs came under intense small-arms fire. Jax heard a dozen mortar tubes coughing rounds as fast as they could be dropped, the shells falling viciously on the other side of the canal. But Jax and his two platoons were pinned down. There should have been slow-flying A-1 Sky Raiders overhead, but inexplicably, the Air Force sent F-100 Super Sabre jets, and they were worse than no support, trying to drop heavy bombs beneath the low cloud cover. When the bombs hit close enough to be effective, they hit friendlies. By the time Sky Raiders finally arrived, it was too late for the 3rd Platoon, and the sun was setting. Jax and his two platoons withstood probing attacks all night, and at dawn, finally fought their way across the canal. Most of the enemy had fled. They found Huckleberry Lewis and clusters of Nungs lying dead on the LZ. Apparently Charlie Vessels had gathered the last of the Nungs and made a final stand in a little cemetery. He was found among another cluster of bodies. The entire 3rd Platoon had been killed or seriously wounded. Jax later learned Lewis and Vessels and their 40 Nungs had landed in front of 2 full Viet Cong battalions, nearly 1,000 enemy, supported by mortars and heavy machine guns. "And all we had was carbines," said Jax. Perhaps the family and friends of Captain Carl Jackson, who have never heard of SOG's top-secret raid, will appreciate the sacrifices made to try to rescue him. He remains MIA. After Jack's men returned to Khantoum, the superstitious Nungs refused to set foot in the annihilated platoon's barracks. Its ghostly silence stood as a haunting testament to the consequences of faulty intelligence. Several green berets poured kerosene on that empty structure, tossed a match and watched the flames build. Then they joined the rest of the men in the NCO club for toasts to Lewis and Vessels and a rendition of Hey Blue. In honor of the Twainsian character whose hands had helped construct it, Fred Huckleberry Lewis, the club that night was christened the Huckleberry Inn. Only a week later, SOG realized its first bright light's success, almost an act of divine redress, because the successful mission was led by Captain Frank Jax. A SOG bird dog spotter plane flying deep in Laos saw an F-105 Thunder Chief fall from the sky, and a parachute drift to Earth. The fighter bomber had been hit by anti-aircraft fire over North Vietnam. A SOG officer and the bird dog, Major Frank Sova, radioed the Doc To launch site. "I can see the parachute and I'm closing in on it. I see him landing. He's out of the chute, and he's into the bushes. Can you crank something up and go get him?" The officer in charge at Doc To, Captain Jax, plotted the downed pilot's location, 70 miles away, beyond the Ho Chi Minh Trail, in an area infested with NVA. Worst of all, the location was well beyond the maximum range of the Hueys. Jax huddled with his Huey crews and challenged them to devise some means to stretch their helicopter's range. In a display of ingenuity, the crew chiefs loaded 55-gallon fuel drums and a hand pump aboard one bird so they could land on the way back, God knows where in Laos, refuel, and return to Vietnam. The sun was low on the horizon when the Hueys took off. By the time they spotted the flyers' pen flares arcing in the near darkness, they could see hundreds of NVA closing in on him. Sergeant First Class Luke Grady Nance, Jr., a Special Forces medic aboard one Huey, saw NVA only 100 yards away when the downed pilot leaped aboard. "When he got in that helicopter, I'll tell you he was one happy fella," Nance says. The pilot looked around in awe and shouted, "Gosh! I didn't know we had Army aviation out here." He was told to forget what he'd seen. Halfway back to Vietnam, the Hueys turned on their landing lights, settled into a grassy field somewhere in Laos, rolled out the 55-gallon drums, pumped like crazy, then off they went. When Jax put the rescued pilot on a C-130 to Saigon, he was as happy as could be. Jax was, too. Colonel Aderholt notes with pride, "That was the first ever night pickup of a downed pilot." Few USAF and Navy aviators were aware SOG teams would go into Laos and North Vietnam after them. To preserve any chance of success, Bright Light had to be an unadvertised service, and it remained one of the best-kept secrets of the war. Declassified records don't clearly disclose how many downed aviators saw SOG teams materialize like guardian angels to rescue them from behind enemy lines. My best estimate is several dozen, and double that if you add aircrew who were downed and rescued while supporting SOG operations. There was an equal number of body recoveries, which, while no occasion for joy, at least gave families positive proof and something to bury, providing at least a degree of mercy. Large numbers of NVA troops and heavy anti-aircraft fire were typical for Laos and Bright Lights, but the North Vietnam ones were always worse, given the greater distances and sophistication of enemy defenses, which at times included SOMs and MiGs. One North Vietnam Bright Light, led by Sergeant First Class Glenn Lane, was within sight of Hanoi when another SOG man hollered to Robert Squirrel Sprouse, "What would you do if you saw a MiG right now?" "Well, I'd shit," Squirrel hollered back, according to Staff Sergeant Robert Spider Parks, another volunteer. The other man pointed, "Well, you'd better start shitting, because there's a MiG." Fortunately, the MiG was more interested in their fighter escort than in the helicopter. Despite the communist fighter, they pressed on to where the downed pilot had been evading, but found such heavy ground fire that the CH-3 Jolly Green couldn't land. Marauding MiGs also aborted a North Vietnam Bright Light for Staff Sergeant Ulysse Presley's recon team, which was attempting to reach the Red River Valley. Every time they entered North Vietnamese airspace, they had to turn back because MiG-21s came up to intercept them. In this case, as in many Bright Lights, tactical problems arose because time lags delayed insertion. JPRC remedied this somewhat by obtaining SOG recon teams for one-week Bright Light duty, literally strip alert, since they were packed and ready to go, 24 hours a day, within 50 feet of an airstrip where Jolly Green helicopters or a C-130 would pick them up. The only notice team members got was their 1-0 walking out of the operations shed and shouting, "Grab your shit, let's go!" Teams on Bright Light duty usually went heavy, bringing along every team member and switching some CAR-15s for M60 machine guns and even a 60mm mortar. Beyond additional ammunition, they carried extra first aid gear, propelling harnesses and helicopter extraction rigs. While these teams might be employed for any kind of Bright Light rescue, most often they went after downed airmen or to look for missing SOG men. Bright Lights were the most consistently dangerous SOG missions, not just because teams went behind enemy lines into an area bristling with anti-aircraft guns, but because the enemy could lie in ambush for them. The enemy often turned a captured pilot's survival radio's beeper or laid out his marker panel to draw rescue aircraft into a trap. In some cases, the North Vietnamese soldier would don a captured pilot's flight suit and helmet, fire pen flares and wave, then collapse. When a rescue helicopter came in to get him, it was blown to bits by anti-tank rockets. In several instances, SOG Bright Lights were aborted at the last minute when a downed pilot managed to slip an odd word or two into his radio conversation, tipping off his rescuers that he was in enemy hands. Sergeant Steve "Jade" Kiever, who rappelled from a hovering Huey into thick Cambodian jungle above a crashed aircraft, gives some sense of what Bright Light men faced. "When you get out on the skids of a helicopter, knowing that you're going to rappel down and you cannot see anything but the tops of trees, you have no idea what's down at the bottom of those trees or underneath that canopy waiting for you." But there was no option. Once the men were on the ground, heavy anti-aircraft fire might drive away the helicopters. A Green Beret medic who rappelled onto a crash site tied his rope to a tree to prevent the Huey's departure, which was only sick humor, since the crew chief could cut the line in a second. Helping airmen downed in North Vietnam remained a subject of unending SOG planning, since only SOG among U.S. agencies had assets in North Vietnam, its agent teams, as well as the only clandestine cargo plane flights into the North's interior. SOG's capabilities in North Vietnam had been expanding at pace with the rest of the war. By 1966, SOG's nationalist Chinese aviators of the 1st Flight Detachment were penetrating North Vietnam's night sky almost monthly. In addition to parachuting supplies and reinforcements to the 5 established agent teams, 1st Flight had inserted another 3 teams. Even the King Bees got into the act. In November 1965, when they landed Team Romeo in the southern panhandle near Muya Pass, the 4 new agent teams plus the 5 surviving ex-CIA teams, Bell, Easy, Remus, Tourbillon, and the singleton Ares, gave SOG 9 teams and 112 agents in the enemy's heartland. SOG had reinforced all the old CIA teams except Ares, with some so expanded that they were almost small platoons. SOG was planning to reinforce Ares by sea, the same way he'd been infiltrated nearly 5 years earlier, but using high-speed nasty boats. During the 3 years the CIA managed the agent team program, 18 of 23 teams were lost, mostly upon landing. By contrast, excluding the malingerers, SOG purposely dumped into North Vietnam in the spring of 1964, SOG had lost not one team, although a few individual team members had been lost in parachute accidents or clashes with NVA patrols. It was an impressive turnaround. But could SOG really entrust these teams with a sensitive and dangerous task like Bright Light? Beyond concerns that some teams might have been captured and doubled, there were serious doubts that agent teams had the mettle for such work. SOG sought a